I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am, but Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Oh yeah,
yeah. Because Matt played it in his DJ set in Bristol, like third song in, and yeah, you know when you hear a song, obviously that's kind of out of sync of the tour you're on. Obviously,
right.
When you're on tours like this, it's kind of punk rock
through
and through. So then, the minute you get something outside of that box, you're like, oh, I just want to go down this rabbit hole now.
Right.
So
right.
We've just been jamming fucking glam and hair metal all the way down here today.
Nice.
So what are you doing later on? Obviously, this will be going out after the show, so there's no chance of spoiling the surprise.
What are we doing later? Well, what, you mean like after the show,
drunk? No, with Hot for Teacher. What's the plan?
Well, I don't know. Casey, the Flogging Molly's tour manager, is an old friend of mine. He's a little younger than I am, but I knew him when he was pretty young as a kid and a Santa Barbara lad.
That's where you grew up as well,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And for some reason, he got it in his mind. I mean, I guess he was listening to a lot of Van Halen. I was listening to Van Halen as a kid. I was listening to Van Halen when, 40 years ago when they first showed up. But
I was reading you're 52 years of age.
I'm 52 years old.
Dude, yeah. You look insane for your age.
What, insanely bad? Thanks.
No, insanely great. You've aged like a fine wine.
It's a lifetime of misadventure. I've certainly not done anything. I don't exercise. I don't eat right. I don't look after myself, a little smoking, a little drinking,
I think the California sunshine goes a long way, doesn't it?
I guess so. So anyway, he wants me to jump up on guitar with the Flogging Molly fellows and run through Hot for Teacher by Van Halen. So it's funny, I've never actually played it before. I did look at a brief tutorial of the intro guitar part a couple times on YouTube, so it'll be a bit of a crapshoot, but I had a look at it. I kind of see what the deal is, and I know
with
song.
That
it was
song,
all over
the drums,
MTV.
Man. The drums,
oh yeah,
and that.
Drums are ferocious.
Yeah.
Well, the Van Halen brothers are ferocious,
yeah.
And they came up, influenced by their dad, who played big band and swing music, and I think that influenced a lot of their earlier output, having such a hot swing beat in a rock context.
And there's almost like a classical element in there as well, isn't there, with
sure.
some of the guitar licks and
oh,
stuff.
Yeah.
They were such...
Well, it's interesting.
So how old were you when they exploded? You were what, like
12.
14, 15, 12?
Yeah, like 78. I was born in 66, so I was like 11 or 12 when that first album came out. It's funny, I used to, as a kid, look at whatever, rock magazines would be in the stores and stuff and just be in awe of the pictures of Jimmy Page with his dragon print, silk jumpsuit and his double necks and all that stuff. And I remember in one of those magazines, it was either like Cream or something. And in the very back of the magazine, there was this little article on this new band, and it was Van Halen. I hadn't heard anything. I don't think most people had. And it was a photo of them all just sort of laying on a bed together, just, with their backs against the backrest. And, I still remember my initial reaction was that, they look a bit greasy and kind of, because you know, all the bands of that time were so like hair, you know. And it's funny because Van Halen was such a hair band and a colorful band, but my first impression was, oh, who's this dirty lot looking so seedy all?
I guess Guns N' Roses had that exact same thing going, didn't they? A little later on, like a decade later,
they did.
Was that kind of street urchin.
Yeah,
feral.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's crazy. I came in on rock, mostly 60s and 70s hard rock and stuff. So I had already been messing around and had a bit of a, you know, an established approach to playing before the shred movement came along in the 80s. But it was exciting to a degree. It just was that for the most part, all the attention paid on blistering licks seemed to be to the detriment of everything else. Bass, drums, and songs, and bands just became just a boring backdrop for the inevitable histrionic guitar solo that would just rip your head off. And though that had a certain novelty and some of the guys had some character to their playing, by and large, it just felt exhausting and unfulfilling. And I missed the days of Deep Purple and Black Sabbath, Queen, you know, early Van Halen, Led
Zeppelin.
So
they were the groups for you. Were you always a bassist first, or were you a guitarist first?
Well, it's hard to say, because I have an older brother who is a guitar teacher, and he's only 2.5 years older than me, but he was a huge influence on me. And the reason I started playing bass was because my older brother Mike was a guitar player. Now, a lot of people know my younger brother Chris.
Is there three of you in total?
There's three of us in total, not counting our stepbrother Steve, but
right.
We never actually lived with Steve, so... I mean, he is family, but, you know, there's the core three Shiflett brothers. And you know, so Mike started on guitar. I naturally, unofficially messed around on his guitars and played his guitars, watched his moves, studied his moves, and picked up licks and stuff. But when it came time for proper lessons, my mom said, what's going to be? In my mind, I always sort of figured I would either be a lead guitarist or a drummer. But the day came, she just sort of hit me with the question, we're going to sign you up for lessons, so what's going to be? And I just kind of, in a panic, I said bass. And it wasn't that I had some drive for bass or an affinity for bass. I just knew that guitar looked daunting and scary. My older brother was already on it. So I figured if I pick another instrument, that'll get us one step closer to a band. So I picked bass. But the reality is, it's interesting. My bass teacher wasn't even a bass player. He was a guitar player. So
your bass style is so unique and incredible, and it's been such a pleasure watching you play every night. And I feel like there's not that many bassists, because I'm not a musician myself, so I'm not clued up as to kind of the technicalities and, you know, the skill set. I can admire talent, but I'm not necessarily clued up to what people are doing. But watching you is very much, I think, in my kind of favorite live bass experiences.
Thanks.
When it
thanks.
Comes to just watching someone own their instrument.
Thanks. Well, you know, what I do in this band is a confluence of so many different things. It's funny because, yes, I'm a bass player, and yes, I love what I refer to as essence bass, which is very finger style and very in the pocket. But what I do in this band is a mixture of a lot of things. I mean, yes, I play bass and I play guitar, and my guitar style owes a lot to the 70s era hotshots like Ritchie Blackmore, Uli John Roth, Michael Schenker, Van Halen, and I'll even throw in Randy Rhoads because he was a huge influence on me, and I consider him more of a 70s holdover than an 80s. You know, he was sort of set the template for a lot of 80s guys. So my approach to guitar has always had a bit of an aggressive hotshot kind of thing. And it's funny, when I play bass in a band, I traditionally fall into like a Geezer Butler, John Paul Jones, or even Paul McCartney sort of mold, which isn't what I do in this band.
Yeah.
But essentially, the template for what face-to-face bass playing is was already established by my predecessor, Matt Riddle, who's an excellent bass player, a very aggressive, busy but melodic in the pocket. He kind of ticked all the boxes in a way. And I think, you know, of course, I loved Steve Harris when I first came upon Iron Maiden, when I discovered them when Killers came out in 81. I wound up seeing them live in 82. It was Bruce Dickinson's first tour with them. They still had Clive Burr on drums, which was excellent. I mean, though, you know,
I saw Maiden recently,
a better
and they
drummer, but
still kill.
Oh yeah,
they're like 70
it.
Years old.
I know.
The energy of a teenager, like.
But so there was something already established to how the bass in this band would be approached in conjunction to like Trevor's style of songwriting, et cetera, et cetera. So
did you join on album 4?
No, album 3. I'm on the self-titled album.
Yep.
And I'm even on the EP that came out maybe just a little before Econo Live, which was us taking the third album out on tour prior to recording, because the idea was to bust the tunes into shape live, which always gives them a different, you know, makes you play them a different way than if you're just in a rehearsal room, to actually get that litmus test of live experience with the material, then cut the record.
Yeah.
So, so that's really, it's a confluence of things. And over time I've certainly, become real aggressive with the more the live end of things, and I'll throw a hot lick in here and there that isn't necessarily on the record, much to Trevor's chagrin. But it's fun for me, and I love it. And I still hunker down onto the material where it needs to be, but there's the reality is just the bass position in this band is demanding as fuck. Pardon me, I cussed on
you. You can say whatever you want, mate.
Excellent.
It's all good.
Poop. So yeah, it's like it's an aggressive, exhausting thing. I think, put an undercurrent of what I consider essence bass. I'm not rattling a string. I'm creating there's a deeper throb, a deeper feel, even if it seems like I'm just hugging a note. I like to think that I'm interjecting the feel as well, but just the parts themselves are, there's a lot of stuff in the just the bona fide tunes that's, it's interesting. The way I approach moving from part to part, yes, I might do a signature riff or something, and then I'll hug a note. I'll hug the note, but it's the Paul McCartney in me that rather than just going from da to da, I'll go da 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 da. You know what I mean? I'll throw a little melodic line to get to the next part, and to me, that's a very Paul kind of thing to do.
They're very melodic songs, and it's not often that I think you hear punk rock done so powerfully and melodically at once.
Right.
I think that makes Face to Face quite a unique band.
Well, I'd like to agree. It's funny, the era that this band springs from, which a lot of people are well aware, is largely considered like 90s punk rock or whatever. But my tastes in rock and punk and all this stuff goes back a lot earlier than that. My favorite punk bands are, for the most part, 70s British punk bands.
Okay. And so when did punk come in for you at the same time as the 60s and 70s hard rock?
Yes and no.
Were you getting into the Clash?
Listen, I've got a picture of my record collection from 74. You see the Beatles, you see David Bowie, you see some Grand Funk Railroad, the Stones. You just see these things in there. There was no real beginning. We've always been listening to music. Periodically I'll come across someone like, I was studying to be an architect, and then I discovered rock out of college.
Yeah.
But not the Shiflet Boys. This was an obsession from as far back as we can remember.
Was that from your parents? Were they musical? Were they interested in
music? They had their musical tastes. My dad was mostly blues and jazz. My mom was kind of the California sound. And I loved their tastes. I listened to their tastes even still to this day. But my older brother, Mike, was really the forerunner of what was our music, which tended to be more late 60s and 70s hard rock. And then I kind of ran with a little bit more of the heavy metal, and my little bro got into some of the glam rock. But we all loved each other's stuff, too. We all covered part of the spectrum, and we all dug each other's music, even if we were all focusing on something specifically from it. But I still remember even though, of course, there's proto-punk and there's the medicine ball of music gets lobbed back and forth generationally. It's like the early 60s Stones and Beatles and some of the garage rock bands of the 60s influenced some of the American bands like MC5 and the Stooges and even early Ramones and stuff, which then lobbed the medicine ball back over here and created that, helped inspire some of the British bands, your Pistols, your Clash, your Jam, and all that stuff. And then, which of course, it just keeps lobbing back and forth and reconstituting. But I still remember...
It's always been this international kind of transatlantic love affair, hasn't it, between the UK and America.
Right. And each iteration spawns a new haircut or pair of trousers that, seems appropriate to wear with it and sort of pushes the thing forward. I actually have an issue of Rolling Stone magazine from like 1968, I think, with Mick Jagger on the cover. It was when it was a fold in half. It was a large parchment paper kind of almost DIY feeling rag more than the glossy pro thing it is now. And one of the bands in there is referred to as a punk rock band. So it's interesting. People are always like, looking for ground zero for some of the things like the terminology and stuff. But most things have to percolate for quite a while before they get there.
Yep.
their chrysalis, their moment where the name meets the look, meets the sound, which was probably 76 London with all the punk bands that were spawned out of there. That became, for me at least, boom, that's punk rock. And I still remember my older brother Mike and I, we were still living in Maryland. It was 1977. And we weren't watching the news, but my dad was watching the news. And, you know, it was back when this burgeoning new movement was enough of a threat and enough of a cultural scare that,
like
it,
Elvis in the 50s, right, or similar,
that it merited news coverage. You know, these people, what are they doing? Sticking safety pins through their clothes and their faces, and they're gobbing on each other and all that crap. But one of the things that stuck with me was, in the little inbox, they had a picture of Johnny Rotten, Johnny Lydon, you know, but they had airbrushed flames all around him. So it just looked, you know, dangerous and menacing. And I remember when that came on, I looked over at my brother Mike, and he looked back at me, and we were both like, what's this? You know, this
I'm having some of that.
Yeah, this seems pretty interesting. So it was really, I say I or we, but it was my, once again, my older brother Mike that managed somehow to get his hands on that Sex Pistols record. So that turned us on. It was 77. We got into some of the first, well, what we considered first wave of British punk. And we hadn't even discovered Deep Purple, Led Zeppelin, Black Sabbath. It's interesting. We were too, I think, too young to join sides, to take sides in a culture war. We were still little kids. And
with the whole anti-long hair,
right, out with the old, in with the new. Yeah, you know, I wasn't even aware of all the stuff that I would eventually grow to love and have be a part of my life. Once we moved in late 77 back to California, where then I went through, you know, the rest of elementary school, junior high, high school, and 10 years of fucking off with my life. my brother Mike, once again, always the forerunner of discovery with the brothers. He checked out of the local library when you could check out records. He checked out a copy of Black Sabbath's Paranoid, brought it home. And for me, that was a life changer. I must have been about 12 or so. And just hearing that record, I wasn't going to not
disown
go
that.
Down that road. To me, I mean, maybe guys who had been listening to it for 7 or 8 years were already over it. And you know, fashion mongers that always want to be trendy or part of something new, they could dismiss it. But to me, music is always, it's first and always will be an emotional medium before it's a fashion or a political medium. It's an emotional medium. You can articulate all you want, where you belong, who you want to sit with. But when a song gets into your head and goes right to your heart and your mind, that relationship is forged instantaneously. It sort of circumvents, it bypasses all logical and critical thinking. So, you know, then it just becomes a sociology experiment, an in and out group thing, like, well, I love this band, but if I admit it to my mates, then they're going to, you know, kick me out of the gang, and I don't want to do that, which is rough business when you're 15, but I'm 52.
It's kind of everything, isn't it?
Right, it is.
It's like you're either in or you're out.
Right, who you want to fit in with. So I heard Sabbath, and my life just was forever changed. And that doesn't, you know, I've never been a guy to disavow things, to take on new things. I still love that the music of that I've always loved, and, you know, it's just, I add more to it than that. You know, just keep letting new things be a part of it. And it all informs the stuff I write. I'm almost schizophrenic, and like, I rarely write the same style song twice in a row. I have to kind of almost try to do that, or else it'll just be all over the map. I just figure over the long enough period of time, I just simply get, here's a handful of folk songs, and here's some punk songs, and here's some, you know, shred songs or whatever.
Do you write very instinctively, or are you a little bit more critical and self-aware and...
You know, I've been writing for so long, I think I've tried my hand at all of it. You know,
yeah.
Sometimes music first, sometimes lyrics first. I do, sometimes I'll have like just almost like a random outpouring, a train of thought as I'm writing lyrics. And then I have to wonder, what do they mean? You know, people are always, some people write very literal songs like Johnny went down to the supermarket and bought himself a pack of crisps or whatever. You know, it's very easy narrative to follow. And
yeah, yeah.
Sometimes my lyrics are a bit more vague and opaque than that. It's, and so even I am not 100% sure what I mean. And I, you know, if it's a little too flowery, I might be a little embarrassed by it. But for the most part, even on, okay, I've recently released only as a download album, a side project that I do called Viva Death.
I was listening to that on the way down here too.
Cool.
Ready to Go was the first song
I heard.
Very, that specific record, very 80s. sounding.
Yes.
I was trying to think of what
it's
reminded me
of. It's almost a new wave record done almost entirely on guitars. But there's some solos, but if you listen to the record, it was almost all made with one guitar, a custom shop Fender Stratocaster, and one bass, an American-made Fender Precision, which I've used on a few of the face-to-face records. I had to go to Boston to make it, so I couldn't bring a quiver of guitars to, you know, indulge my fancy whims. We decided to make this record in a very different style to the earlier ones. This is the fourth Viva Death record. It's called Illuminate.
Did it start off as a project with you and Chris, and then over the years it's become just yours?
No,
is it?
It started out as a project with Trevor from Face to Face and I. We bought matching baritone guitars and just got real excited over our new toys, built a band around it, never intending to make even a record. But our former manager, who was part owner of a record label, made the fatal mistake of saying, I'll fund a record. So that was his blowing it. But it started a project that, you know, I would have never probably done, because I know that my tastes and some of my more personal writing is a bit more esoteric, and it's a harder sell. And quite frankly, I'm not out to convince people to enjoy what I do. If you hear it and you dig it, great, get into it. But I'm not going to tap dance for your approval or affections. Not with that project anyway.
Yeah, you know, that's for you.
That's just for me. I hate to use the term artists, a bit, you know, arrogant or whatever, but an artist without a benefactor buying your brushes and paints, you have to buy your own brushes and paints. And that's how I feel about Viva Death. I finance it. And, you know, after that first album, of course, they didn't know what to make of it when we turned that thing in. They
were a left turn.
Right.
Yeah.
So basically, Trevor, oddly enough, instigated the second album. He said, let's make a second one. And I said, I will not ask those folks for money. They didn't want that first record. Forget it. And he was like, I already got a budget. I was utterly surprised. And then I was also surprised that he didn't really seem as into the collaboration as he was. So he strangely instigated a second record, but wasn't really as prolific
hands-on
on the writing.
Involved, yeah.
We really half and halved the first album. It was more of a collaboration. And I wrote all but one song on the second record. And then by the third record, I took over all duties. I play the drums. I played all the bass and everything. The first two albums were just baritone guitar, because that was the impetus. We wanted to see, could we make records without bass or standard guitar using only this exotic-ish instrument, the baritone guitar? It was just more of a artistic experiment. Could we get away with this? And, you know, some people thought not. I think we did. You know, I think, you know, I deliberately wrote the songs so that the parts would fill the spectrum. There would be a so-called bassy section, even though, you know, it's not down as low as a bass, the middle part, some lead parts. But though, here, okay, back to the point of how it started. I didn't want it to be a project, which it was. It was always a project. So I roped my little brother, and we eventually got Josh Fries from Nine Inch Nails and Sting.
Yeah, and every band ever.
Perfect Circle. And
He's a busy dude.
The Vandals. He is one of the busiest dudes and an amazing talent. And considering the speed we were trying to, you know, travel, he, for me as a musician and having to, you know, work quickly and on the fly
and
on a
cheaply
project,
as well, right? I guess.
I was bro rated.
Yeah.
Absolutely. He comes in, you know, he'd come to my house. I'd play in my demos. I would, you know, drum on my legs to articulate the parts. And he's so fantastic. He can nail it in one take in the studio and give you what you want in the character of the song in one take.
Is that why he's so in demand and so widely used?
I'll bet 70-80% of what you hear on the radio is secretly him drumming. One time years ago, my wife was the scheduling coordinator for a studio in Los Angeles, and he was there doing a Wilson Phillips project. I'm sure he doesn't mind me mentioning that now. But he was a little bit embarrassed and asked her not to tell me why he was there.
Yes, she promptly threw him
under the bus. He was there doing Wilson Phillips. But I don't judge, man. You know, he's a professional. That's what you do. But I felt real honored when at one point he was, you know, here's a guy who's played on 700 plus records, probably 1,000 by now. He was asked in one, I don't know if it was Drummer Magazine or Modern Drummer, I'm not sure, to list his 10 favorite albums. And one of my Viva Death records was one of them. I was very honored. You know, I cut him loose as well as I, you know, the songs have their structure, but there's a freedom within that structure. And I just kind of, you know, that's the beauty of Fries, is that he does understand the character of what you're doing. He doesn't just go in there and kind of blindly thrash it out, even in perfect time. He gets where you're going. So anyway, roped my brother into it. It looked like a band. It walked, it talked like a band, but it was never a band. It was always a project. So when it came time to do the third album, it was just a case of, I felt guilty asking everyone to come and you know, give old man Shiflet a break and dedicate your time. And there was always a part of me that wanted to kind of be a really bad Paul McCartney drummer on my record. You know, every half-assed drummer wants to take a stab at it. And so that was the third album for me, which is ironic because I love sloppy drumming. And then when I hear me doing it, I kind of cringe a little bit. But it's weird. I have friends that like that album the best because they like my shitty drumming. So, but back to this.
That.
Right. Back to this fourth album, we decided, you know, by now my main partner in crime, Chad Blinman, who was recording engineer and mixer and co-producer of a lot of the Face-to-Face records, he was living in Boston teaching at Berklee College of Music. And so I had to fly out there. I can only bring one bass and one guitar. But we had, you know, I had no money. So it was like, well, let's see what we could do. Well, he has a project on the sly called Real Space Noise, where he programs everything. And he is a drummer. You know, he used to drum for Das Ick and Ikor and all these kind of gothy bands and stuff. And
is goth a sort of a subgenre or a subculture that you identify with or enjoy?
I do, but you know what? I not with, you know, I think like a lot of things, what things become scarcely resembles what they started out as.
Yeah.
I love Susie and the Banshees and Bauhaus, but I don't think of that. I don't think they even relate to the kind of cliched version of what goth is, not to offend anybody, but for my money, you know, the stuff from back then was a different animal. Same with hard rock or even heavy metal. I'm sure it's just something that comes with age and passing time. You always prefer the first time you heard it in its earlier iterations and stuff. And I don't mean to be a dick about it. And I would never profess that I loved my music any more than someone else loves theirs. That's music being subjective.
But you like what you like.
I like what I like.
Does.
And, you know, I'm not going to pretend otherwise to appear hip or current. I just can't do that, you know. So, but anyway, so for this latest record, Chad programmed all the drums. So it's all drum programming, which is funny because we joke that so many bands nowadays sample and trigger and then time compress and move things about to that it scarcely resembles an authentically performed performance anyway. We just skipped the middleman.
Yeah.
Technically. But, you know, he's an artist at his programming, in my view. And it was just another thing. And it won't be the same thing on the next record. We're already talking about being a little bit more minimalist, dark wave kind of thing. And the beauty of the project is that it doesn't owe anything to anyone, even myself. You know, what started out as this is the baritone band, we chucked that out of the window by the third record.
So you can go anywhere with it.
We can do anything.
The joy, right? That's the thrill.
I just consider it a free playpen corner for me. I get to, you know, I know I'm taking the long route to get back to this, but
hey, that's the beauty of podcasts.
Right. So it's back to like my lyrics. On the earlier stuff, I kind of almost had an anti-commercial bent. So on the part of the song that would traditionally go to the big sing-along chorus, I would just go to a vamp and then off to another verse or something. But I think there's more what I would consider standard structures and commercial, not commercial, but, you know, catchy choruses or whatever.
As
good as Viva Death's going to do them.
Conventional.
Right. On this latest album. And some of the guys that I've worked with, like Joe Gastwert, who's a legend in the mastering business, you know, he likes this one the best. I've heard that from a lot of people, and I think it's a good listen. And, you know, we, once again, showing my age, I love the album experience, and we've always made these records to be like just put it on, let it play, put your puffy headphones on, smoke a joint, whatever you like to do, and just let it ride.
I know that the album game isn't what it used to be, but I do feel like headphone records, now is the perfect time to be making those, because probably 80% of people who are listening to music at any point and nowadays listen to them on their headphones because they're probably listening on their phone. And so the headphone record, I think now is the time that should come back.
I think you're right. Well, you know, I don't have kids, but I'm always hearing from my friends that have kids. And at my age, they're, for the most part, adult kids. They don't listen to albums. They just call out, you know, Alexa, play fucking Sklibbity Doobity Bop or whatever. but it's funny. My dad in the 70s had a big like Pioneer and Kenwood and all the, you know, real to real stuff.
Beautiful old hi-fis, yeah.
Yeah, like ordering his needles from Germany and all that crap. And, you know, we always used to joke that the audiophile is dead. And you know, the first iteration of portable music was the Walkman.
Yep.
It was a cassette system. It was not unlike what people are doing now. Get your headphones and all that stuff. So, you know,
with mixtapes as well, right? Obviously, like,
so we were doing that.
Compile your favorite songs
almost 40 years ago. By, you know, 81 or two, you know, most of my pals, we all had those, and you know, it's just still kind of the same thing, just more technologically advanced, better sound quality. But the thing is that, you know, it's not an audiophile medium. Yes, the sound is getting better, but for the most part, we were skateboarding down the street. You're not exactly. It's not high fidelity yeah. that you're concerned about. It's portability. And, you know, when you're young, especially, you're more forgiving about a loss in sonics and dynamics. And half of the time people are listening to music, me included, is in my car when I'm, you know, driving around, all the ambient noise. So rarely am I listening to music under those kind of like high tech, high scrutiny, high fidelity
and enclosed,
conditions.
Solitary yeah, yeah. confinement space.
I don't think very many people do
no.
anymore.
The world's too busy and constantly distracted and on the go, isn't it now?
Yeah.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas, big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
What about the Gimmies? What's your history and timeline with that project?
That goes back for me. Well, my first, well, here's an interesting backstory. Listen, pre-Gimmies, when my little brother was still living in Los Angeles, and we were living with Bill Armstrong, who runs Side One Dummy Records, who signed Flogging Molly originally. He's one of my best friends growing up. We still talk on the phone all the time. Chris, Bill, and I had a band together, briefly including Josh Fries in Los Angeles in the early 90s. But I go back to 1980, 81 with Bill Armstrong. We had a joke idea that never came to fruition. It was going to be a band called Clown Fight. And the point of the
band...
That's
a great band name.
We were going to dress as clowns, get as drunk as we could, and play punk rock covers of 80s pop songs. That was the idea. I went so far as to going out and buying a clown suit for myself, giant blue shoes, the, you know, red nose. I bought everyone else that was going to be in the band a red clown nose. But that was as far as I was going to go. They were going to have to go get their own clown suits.
You interpret your own individual
right.
looks.
Now, it never got off the ground. It was just one of those drunken conversations that we just held on to that we would do. And then when my brother moved up north to originally just get a job at Fat Records and stay up there, I was originally going to move up there with him. We were going to maybe do a side project with Joey Cape from Lagwagon, who's an old friend of mine for years. I played in bands with Joey prior to Lagwagon, like Chemical and stuff like that. Joey's older brother, shredding guitarist, TJ, still a shredding guitarist and a sweet dude. But 2 weeks before the move, I backed out because I have never been good at adulting. Even though I'm older now, I'm still a 16-year-old in terms of my ability to you know, behave like a proper adult. And I knew I was never going to get a job and I would probably wind up dead and broke if I went up there. Chris already had an intern job at Fat lined up. So I just told him, man, I'm staying in LA, which I did, which ultimately worked out because I wound up joining Face to Face. But not long after Chris goes up there, they create this band where they dress in costumes, get as drunk as they can and play cover songs of other songs. And it wasn't specifically 80s. And even though I know they didn't rip the idea off, I always felt like I kind of have a prehistory to the concept anyway. So, you know, and I was always and I was surprised they made a first record. I thought it was just going to be a local gag that they would do until their livers gave out. And then they made a second record, a third record. And then by the 2003 Warped Tour, Chris had to leave for some reason. And they roped dudes from other bands to come up and play songs. I got up and played two songs. So that was my first introduction. But the next year, 2004, my little bro, Chris, called me up and asked, hey, how would you feel about doing a two-week tour filling in with the Gimmies? I think he was saying, you know, some of the guys that get filling in, they covet the gig. They want to try and, you know, be the guy on the records and all that stuff. So for me, I have no such aspirations. And so I was, you know, yeah, I'll jump in and I'll cover it. And I'm not out to steal your gig. You're my brother and it's your gig, you know, always has been, always will be in my mind. So it's ironic that almost 15 years later, I'm still doing the
gig. Still filling in.
I think I was filling in for Brian Baker of Bad Religion. But, you know, the interesting thing is I was instrumental in teaching my little brother how to play guitar. So I know that there's a crossover in some of the style and whatnot. So I could pick that shit up real quick. And I think I was maybe the first guy in a handful of dudes that was playing the songs correctly.
Yeah.
And which they liked. Plus from a distance, everyone thought they were seeing Chris just from the family resemblance. And no matter how many times I'd say I'm Scott, or even they announced me as Scott, people are like, Chris. So they probably got what they wanted, that the fill-in was covering the spot, playing the parts correctly, and looked enough like the real dude that they didn't have to worry about it. So
the
they
dream
just kept
standing.
Yeah, you know, I never said, hey, I want to count me in or anything. They just kept calling, and I just kept doing it. And I've known some of the guys forever. Like Joey, I've known almost 40 years, you know, and I've known Fat Mike since about the time NoFX was recording White Trash, Two Heebs and a Bean.
I think... So that's still to this day my favorite NoFX album. I love that album.
I was in the studio when El Jefe was cutting his guitar solos for that. Yeah.
Wow. I mean, that's why I think I like it, is because it's obviously the first record with him. It's when a lot more of that comedy that we now know and love about them really kind of formulated.
Right.
And he obviously brought in his trumpet playing and just that. I think their sort of birth for me was that album, as the band we know and love today.
And it's interesting. A lot of bands... you know, there's the guy with the vision. A lot of punk rock bands, there's somebody that has the punk spirit and the punk vision, but those guys need really talented guys also. So they have to pull from a real diverse pool of musicians to fix the flat, the proverbial flat. If your band needs a guy, you can't sit around finding some dude that just because he's got spiky hair or whatever, you need somebody that can cut it and cut it real quick. So El Jefe is one of those dudes. He didn't have a punk background.
No.
You know, and even like The Clash, Topperhead, and, you know, he's a jazz cat. He just figured he'd take the gig for a couple months till something better came along. Yeah, you know, that's, and then, you know, punk history is made. And of course, having a real talent like that in your band just elevates your game, whatever you're doing. I always thought that was kind of an interesting thing. So many of the so-called punk bands of the 90s were ex-rock guys and shredder dudes that, you know, were no longer allowed by pop culture to do endless guitar solos. So they had to find some other way to keep playing.
When Chris goes up to work, in fact, is that how he then ends up in No Use for a Name?
Were you already interning
in Face to Face, or what was those
kind
of two timelines?
No, he actually joined No Use for a Name before I was in Face to Face. I had a little bit of time after Chris and my last band dissolved in a sea of drug addictions and fistfights. And he went up there because he had that job, but so... No Use needed a guy. Well, there's that Chris dude that they were calling Jake Jackson, because I guess there was already a Chris working there. So they dubbed him Jake Jackson. And he was only a month or two up there before he got tapped. And, you know, my brother is well known now as a wealth of talent on the guitar. And I know that didn't take but 3 seconds to be discovered once he was up there. Oh, my God, this dude is incredible. Let's get him in on something. And so No Use for a Name needed a guy. He got the gig, and It's funny, the first time I actually saw them playing, they were in LA playing a place formerly called the Palace. I don't know what it is anymore, but I just came in off the street, you know, and my brother was up on stage. They were setting their stuff up and he looks out and he sees me and he motions, get over here. So I come around the side, he gets me up on the stage and he goes, I don't have a tech. Will you tech for me? So I basically watched my first No Use for a Name gig with my own brother in it, sitting on the side of the stage, tuning his guitars and handing him fresh ones every couple songs.
Amazing.
So, yeah, it was a cool vantage point to see. He was in the band, made a couple records, and then, blessed their hearts and, you know, fantastic. I actually filled in for Chris's replacement, Dave Nazzi, on a month-long tour playing lead guitar using one of my brother Chris's guitars with No Use for a Name. But whatever people want to say about it being a chump move or a sellout move, I couldn't disagree more. I think my brother's talents have been put more to use in the Foo Fighters than No Use for a Name. And there was a whole lot of that towing the line in the 90s where people, you know, were almost afraid to stretch out for fear that they were going too far. And, you know, I've always been well aware of what he's capable of. So I felt like, well, it's a cool band. Tony writes cool songs. But I always felt my brother could do more. And so I'm glad to see that, you know, for a number of reasons that he landed another gig and continues to stretch his wings and do other music. So
I think it's that almost like self-hatred from within the punk police, isn't it?
Right.
That success is somehow meant to be the enemy.
Right. Well,
and you shouldn't
funny.
Strive for more. You should be eating out of a garbage can. And
when he joined the band
money.
At first, I was playing a face-to-face gig. And I remember... we were walking on stage and a voice in the crowd yelled, your brother's a sellout. And I knew damn well they were talking to me instead of anyone else. And I didn't get into a confrontation about it because you just can't win with that kind of person. But I just remember in my mind thinking, you have no idea how much I disagree with you, sir. But I'm not going to get into it now. I've got my own gig to play. But no, you're wrong. End of story.
Do you remember the day when you heard the news? And
yes,
how
because
did that news get delivered?
It got delivered because, once again, our original guitarist, Chad Yarrow, he was always a bit difficult relying on to make tours. You know, he was quitting the band every other Thursday, it seemed. And so we were constantly faced with the threat of like a day or two before a tour, him pulling out. And I remember we had a desperate situation going where we had a tour coming up and Chad was pulling his usual, I'm out, fuck this business. And I'm not meaning this to slag him because there's so many differences between us, but I love him so much. I consider him a lifetime family friend. You know, he will always be my dear, dear brother, Chad. But he was a difficult little fucker back in those days. And he pulled out of a tour again. And I was just looking to fix a flat temporarily. I wasn't asking Chris to join our band or anything, you know, unless he wanted to. Hey, open for that. But I called him up and I was like, hey, you know, we have this thing. If you're free and you feel like doing it, love to have you come out. And he goes, actually, I'm about to drive. He was living up in San Francisco at the time. He goes, I'm driving down to LA to audition for the Foo Fighters, but please don't tell anyone. I think, you know, he just didn't want it to get out there in case, you know, it didn't happen or whatever. I, you know, just protecting himself a little bit. And I was like, no way, unbelievable. And so maybe a day later, he calls me up with the good/bad news. Well, the good news is I got the gig. Bad news is you got to figure your own problems out. And I don't remember what we did. I think we might have toured as a 3-piece or tricked Chad back in for a few more shows. Because that's how we always had to do it. Have our manager offer him more money or whatever. All right. So I was nothing but happy for him. You know, not to spill too much of his personal life, but, you know, things weren't great at that time with No Use for a Name's career. My brother was delivering pizzas between tours and worrying about where his life was headed. He was confiding in me that he was interested in, you know, going to business school and moving in back in with our dad and, you know, to facilitate this. So for me, landing that gig was a godsend, you know, for him. And I've only ever been for it, you know. And the rest of the dudes are great. I would never profess to know them well, but they've always, you know, the relations of band members is always a touchy thing in any band, because, you know, you're almost forced to be polite because you don't want to piss off or alienate your fellow band members. But sometimes these people can be absolute fucking nightmares. Now, obviously, I've never been on the level they are professionally and career-wise, but I am a musician and I do spend my life in bands, and I'm well aware of protocol and behavior and what, you know, the do's and don'ts of how to act. And I would never go in their room and kick their shit over and start punching people or anything like that. But I know it's a rough thing. They've only ever been really kind and gracious to me, and I'm very thankful for that. I almost never see them, but it's cool. Nice dudes.
I guess the reason, or other than his talent, one of the main reasons why he probably got the gig is because he did come from a punk rock background.
Yes.
And as much as people bag on the Foo Fighters, and they are an arena rock band,
right,
they're obviously very much in touch with those roots.
Listen, people tend to forget, I didn't see these tours, but one of my best friends saw one of the earliest tours when I guess the Foos were opening for Mike Watt. You know, they're driving around and in a van, they're setting up their own gear. They're, you know, Dave's barely saying two words to the crowd. They're playing Van Halen covers or whatever. They had to fight their way back to that. Now, granted, yes, they had the vapor trail of public sympathy after the death of Kurt Cobain on their side. And he, you know, it takes more than that to continue. It takes having talent, perseverance, charisma, and motherfucking charm, you know, and Grohl's got that in spades. And he was able to parlay that into a huge career. And I see nothing wrong with that at all. You know, I say the same thing about Kiss. Listen, I loved Kiss, but my era of Kiss is like 74, 75.
Juice, Strutter.
77. All that shit. Yeah. Fantastic.
Cold Gin, Black Diamond.
And I say, you know, the novelty of explosions and Kabuki makeup would wear thin if they didn't have the tunes to back it. And I think they have the tunes to back it. So, yeah, early Kiss.
Abso-fucking-lately. Yeah. What was your sort of dance with the major label kind of business world? Because the mid-90s, I think, was the time when a lot of those big labels wanted a piece of the punk pie, didn't they? Off the back of Nevermind and Dookie.
You know, here's the thing. I never paid attention to any of that shit. I grew up not giving a fuck how old people were, whether they were any certain ethnicity or what sex they were. Never cared whatsoever what label a person was on. I never thought of that shit. I only saw the records, heard the music, and kind of, you know, concerned myself with that. There's this whole other element to fandom that utterly eluded me, and I was so well entrenched in how I viewed the world and music that by the time it even dawned on me that that was a thing, I thought those people were fucking morons. I'm sorry, but if you only listen to bands from a certain label or of one particular genre, to me, you're trying too hard.
Absolutely.
You're forcing it, and it seems disingenuous and intellectually suspect to a degree. Never cared, never knew. And oddly enough,
were you guys courted and mistreated?
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
Listen, before I was even in the band, I was well aware of some of the controversies surrounding Face to Face. They signed to Victory, I think it was, which was a subsidiary of maybe A&M, which, you know, it's not a major. It was a mid-level. It wasn't a DIY. It wasn't the big label. Yeah. It was sort of an intermittent zone, which they still got untold amounts of shit about. You know, the irony is that I was working as a shipping receiving clerk when I got the call to audition for them, and I ignored it. I had seen them live 3-4 times. I figured, you know, if they need a bass player, they've got problems, and if they got problems, I don't want to be a part of it. Even though I'm hearing their song Disconnect on the radio 10 times a day.
That song was huge at that time, right?
It was a regional hit in LA. It really never broke worldwide. No,
wasn't it in
really.
A couple of movies and stuff?
Sure. Tank Girl or something.
Right.
So I joined a band. I joined them at the end of the Big Choice cycle. I joined in late 95. And we start working on the tunes for what would be the self-titled album. Trevor had it mostly written. And at one point, I don't really, you know, because I was utterly, you know, pretty oblivious to the business, being the new guy. More than anything, I'm just trying to learn the tunes and ingratiate myself with these dudes that I'm just now getting to know, you know, the original guys, Rob, Chad, and Trevor. I had nothing to do with the business. You know, they didn't let some new guy come in and start getting involved at all, you know. And I wouldn't have known anyway, because I've just always been a little bit stupid when it comes to how all that works. But I do remember at some point...
Blissfully ignorant.
Yeah, thank you. I do remember at one point something came up about how we're now free agents. Victory dropped the band or collapsed or something happened where we were no longer held to that. And we even went so far for, you know, we were just talking like, well, what label would we like to go to? Honestly, I was more listening to the conversation than contributing to it because I didn't have an idea what would be the right thing to do. But we went so far as, you know, ironically, somebody said, as long as it's not A&M, and we even had one rehearsal where we wrote a song, We Won't Sign with A&M. We were singing that over and over. And ironically enough, we found out later, we didn't get to choose our label. We got absorbed into A&M Records. So they just kind of accepted or took the contract or some fucking thing. I may have that completely wrong, but that's kind of what my memory of it was. And, you know, it was a lot of learning. I was pretty adult to be learning these lessons. I was 29 when I joined the band, which by some estimates was, you know, long in the tooth to be joining a punk band. I only think, you know, I'm enjoying music, so I didn't really care that much about what, you know, how that worked out. But I was probably, by the time we were off A&M, like 30, 31 or whatever, and or on A&M and stuff. And, you know, I remember the hard lesson of discovering that we're being farmed out to play radio shows to earn Dishwalla spins. You know, it's always like, if you don't play these shows, they won't play your single. But I learned pretty quickly, they're not going to play it anyway. And that's all that like politicizing in the music business. It's all that shit that I really didn't know at the time. But I only just, I eventually just kind of figured we jump through hoops for these fuckers and they don't play our stuff anyway. So I got really kind of combative about it. Like, fuck them. Fuck that. No, I won't do their show. You know, fuck that. And so I think a lot of times, my steadfast kind of stance on things alienated me from the business side, and Trevor and Rich had a tendency to kind of just run with their own agenda and not even inform me because they didn't want to have to contend with what my opinion on things was going to be. They just sidestepped it. So I would just get an email. We're doing this, we're doing that. Oh, okay, whatever. I tended to not disagree since I wasn't calling the shots anyway. I, you know, book the tours, I go play them. That's kind of how it usually goes. And nowadays, yeah, I'll say yes or no to stuff, but, you know, we're always a little bit in that boat. I benefit from having other people put together a lot of the business side of things.
Have you managed to maintain a certain enjoyment level and kept your appreciation?
That's just what I was getting to, so thank you for asking.
It stayed pure.
Listen, I did try to get involved. I tried to attend meetings, and everyone's always, it's so important that you, you know what's happening with your career and that you're on top of every little thing. But quite frankly, I found it made me a miserable asshole about the whole fucking thing. And I didn't start playing music to get girls. I started because music moved my soul. I didn't do it to be an asshole to other people. If your band is doing well, that's fucking great. I don't have a I'm not in competition with you, whether you're the small band, the medium band, or the big band. I'm just here to do music, man. I'm not your enemy or any of that shit. You know, I just, to me, when you've gotten to that point, you've just fucking, you've been poisoned.
Yeah.
And I honestly did. I just decided, fuck this, I'm out. You guys can steer this ship any way you want. I'm going to handle what I handle best. I'm going to try and write and produce and perform to the best of my abilities with as much love and passion for what I do. And so when I go to my grave, I know that I left a lot of blood, sweat, and good tears on that stage, you know? Because so many people are reaching for the proverbial brass ring in this business and still don't get it. And they spend their whole life kind of like blowing off what they really wanted to do to succeed, and they still don't succeed. So at
and
the
they
very
don't find
least
happiness either.
Right. So, you know, life is short and it moves real quick. Trust me. You know, I can't even believe that I'm here now. It feels like I've been alive for 1,000 years, and sometimes it feels like it's just been last week that, you know, I've picked up a bass, and I'm still trying, kind of honoring the desires of the 16-year-old me. And I guess I kind of get a lot of that out in well, no one's holding me back in face to face. It's just that I have been partially responsible for pissing people off with my esoteric songwriting style. Ignorance is Bliss was the first album that I was a significant writer on. Now, that was Trevor and I. We were both kind of really pushing the limits on that one. But I felt a little guilty at first when everyone hated it so fucking much. It's kind of a cult classic to a percentage of our fan base. But it did at the time absolutely chop our fan base off by about 2/3 because it wasn't in step with the movement at the time. And alienated everyone, our fan base, our label, our management, radio. They just didn't understand. They thought God is a Man was a misogynistic song, which is really about, you know, religion is a man-made creation. They just didn't get what the lyrics were about. And just immediately they wouldn't play it because they figured it was just some macho thing about God is a dude, got a big swinging dick and all that stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
But also again on the 3/4 and a half truth, I was a primary songwriter of the music on that album. And for me, it was more paying homage to the 70s style punk that I came up on. But once again, most of the people that are aware of this band, that's not their cup of tea to begin with. So that was another dark horse. And so I've kicked our fan base in the teeth a few times. So I try to keep my weirder shit on my side projects and my more straight ahead stuff, which I'm not writing under duress because I love this band and I love writing for this band as well. It's just hard to divvy some stuff up. Periodically, I'll write something not for this band, but Trevor will insist we use it. And same with Trevor. He's written things where he almost didn't want to play it for me. And then I heard it and I said, we are doing that in this band. So, you know, there's a love of what we do and a camaraderie to it. I enjoy working together and being partners in this thing. But then, of course, I also love just sort of taking the reins and doing whatever the hell I want on my side project.
And what about Dennis as well? What a great energy he is.
Yes, I've actually known Dennis longer than I've known Trevor. I first met Dennis in the early 90s. And he was in the Poor Boys, I believe, at that point. It was a local band. They were kind of having a hot moment. And I've always loved Dennis. I think he's an immense talent. He's immensely gifted as a songwriter, singer, and guitarist. And it's almost that his talents are kind of being wasted in this group, and I'm just glad he's here. Because like I said, Chad is family. But I've known Dennis longer than Chad. So having him in the band, it never felt like we, you know, had to get some new dude and get to know you. It's still family. And the reality is he's 80 times the guitarist Chad is. And I don't mean that disparagingly because, like I said, I love Chad to death. But having Dennis in the band, there's so much horsepower under that hood. We can barely contain it.
It's just a cool energy as well.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Hey, Bubba. What's up, Bubbas? Doing the Bubbas.
Scott, I think that is about time you need to head inside and jam out some Hot for Teacher, dude.
Cool. I'm sorry to talk over you so much, but no. I'm a jabberjaw, dude. That's how I am.
The floor is yours. When the guest is on, it's their time to talk, and cool. I really enjoyed that.
Cool.
And thanks for giving up your time,
pleasure,
dude. Thanks
man.
For
Thank
having
you.
Me out on this
Absolutely.
Run with you.
Absolutely. Appreciate it.
And when will I see you again? What's going to happen?
I have no idea. You know, we do this. We have the three post-Christmas acoustic shows coming up at Marty's on Newport in Tustin. And after that, you know, there's a lot of dates cooking up for either the acoustic, because, you know, face-to-face, we're technically our latest album is Hold Fast Acoustic Sessions. We did acoustic renditions of our songs from throughout our career. I think it came out fantastic. So we're really enjoying going out and playing those gigs. Very different than the full punk rock set. And
good songs are good songs though, right?
Great.
And I think once you break it down,
it's interesting. Even my wife's like, wow, I really understand the lyrics and these songs are fantastic. Not that she didn't like them before, but that's always kind of nice to hear.
Yeah.
Oh, these are really fucking good songs. So yeah, I think that the change in stylistic approach is actually affording people the opportunity to see that even those early shitty sounding records had some really good stuff on it. And there's a reason why people were into this band then. So
there's going to be hopefully more shows in that format.
Yes. I just love that, sort of like how the Bronx has Mariachi El Bronx.
The best.
Think that it's opened us up to having kind of two different versions of our band. You know, if we could really make the acoustic thing stick, I really enjoy doing it. Plus, I play finger style and not with a pick, which I feel is it honors kind of like the traditionalist in me as a bass player.
Right on.
Yeah, so.
And your brother's got a country album out, right?
Yes.
Or coming out?
I don't know the name of it. He's got two or three of them, and he's always out at work doing the Chris Shiflett thing. You know, originally he had Jackson United, which I played bass on both of those records. Then he had Chris Shiflett and the Dead Peasants. And then I think he snipped off the Dead Peasants and he just goes out as Chris Shiflett, does like solo acoustic stuff now. So
would you ever do that? Would you ever go out solo?
No. I admire the hell out of all the Chris Shiflets and Joey Capes that'll take an acoustic guitar and just go out in front of people. But I've always been terrified of rejection. And in all honesty, my health is always a bit too fragile. I lose my voice readily. I could never book a tour and be certain that I'd have a voice from night after night. And I'm insecure. I'm an insecure singer. You can tell. You hear my records. I'll dim the lights, belt back some scotch, and throw a performance down. But I don't know if I could do it with a bunch of people staring at me, judging, watching. What are you doing? No, you know, it's possible. People keep goading me on, when are you going to do a live Viva Death thing? And for years I said I never would. But now I'm actually starting to think I might slap together a live version and just do a live show, record it, and do a live album of kind of like a best of the four albums or whatever, you know. It sounds like it would be fun. But there's an exposure and a intimacy to just, you know, one person, one acoustic guitar, that quite frankly, to be perfectly honest, I don't know that I have the courage to take on.
Well, as you say, life is short, though.
I know.
And you only get one shot. So
I've got some of that material.
Maybe you'll feel different down the line.
It's just on cassettes in a drawer somewhere at my house. Yeah. Sad Scott. My voice tends to be more of like an Elliott Smith thing. I've never been a power singer. And in fact, similar to what he did, I never felt comfortable singing in my apartments with my neighbors all around me. I felt insecure. And so my voice kind of got into a wispy, whispery kind of thing. And so my stuff's real quiet. Yeah. We'll see how that works out.
The polar opposite to your bass playing. In this band,
and at least. What I found is oftentimes guys that aren't great singers are amazing players, like Uli John Roth. Bless you, mate. I'm so sorry I have to throw you under the bus, but you cannot sing. And at least you know it now and don't try it anymore. But so his guitar playing is just immense. And, you know, oftentimes great singers are a bit rudimentary on guitar because they're able to express themselves well with their vocal styling. I'm as strong a player I am because something has to do that singing, and it's not going to be my voice.
Yeah. Scott, right on, dude.
Right.
Thanks
on.
Again, dude.
Thank you.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.